Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of June 22nd through 29th. And I'm joined this week by Father Jim McDermott. Welcome, Father Jim.
Good day, Tim.
Well, Jim, we are talking today about an article titled Gone Walkabout that's appearing in this issue about the time you spent in Australia.
That's right.
This was part of your tertianship, which is the final stage of Jesuit formation. But to those, you know, non-Jesuit groupies out there, maybe you could just sort of describe that for them.
Is a non-Jesuit groupie someone who isn't a Jesuit who's a groupie, or a person that's a groupie about non-Jesuits? Which is that? A groupie against Jesuits? Would that be an anti-Jesuit groupie?
There are a lot of those.
And probably more the more I just kind of talk on and on. So tertianship. I'll explain it, but at the end of it, you'll say, I still don't know what this is. My parents basically said, well, so you got 6 or 7 months vacation in Australia. That's as best as they could understand. In the Jesuits, when you first enter, you're called a novice. Okay. And you do that for 2 years. And then when you finish that, then you're a scholastic. You're a man in formation. There are some men who take the brother track, so they're never going to be ordained priests, but they still do some formation work. And then there are others who are called scholastics who are going to become priests. That stage, whether your brother or priest, that's going to go on until you go and do tertianship. So it's past ordination, which is what most people are sort of like, well, you're already ordained. What else is there? But there's this last stage called tertianship. And what tertianship is it's basically, it's an opportunity to do some things that you did when you first entered the society again, but you're so much farther along that it's like they're completely new sorts of experiences. So you do a 30-day silent retreat, which is sort of the foundation of our life as Jesuits. You do some work with people who are on the margins or who are poor. You study our history and our constitutions again, the spiritual exercises or the autobiography of Ignatius. And you live together. You live with other guys who are in this stage of formation, this final stage. So it's for me, it was 7 months. Some guys do it in 2 summers. Some do it in there's an 8 or 9 month program in Boston. There are lots of different programs. But it's to take the graces that God has given you and kind of allow God to take them deeper to sort of help you in your life as a Jesuit.
Now, you had a few choices.
Does that make any sense?
To me, it does.
It's a 7 month vacation.
It's a sabbatical for Jesuits.
Exactly. It's an excuse to go to Australia. What can I say?
As you write in your article, you didn't do a lot of traveling when you were younger. How did you choose Australia? I mean, it's, you know, obviously on the other side of the world.
I had been to England once in college, and I had been pretty recently, I had been to Rome once. But other than that, I'd never lived anywhere outside the country other than Canada for a couple months. So I was looking for, if my province would agree, I wanted to have an experience that would expand my horizons and would take me outside of the United States. But my language skills were minimal. Like I can read a bunch of languages, but in terms of speaking on a day-to-day basis, it would just be word soup in Mexico or someplace like that. So there are a bunch of English-speaking programs, and I knew a number of people who had gone to Australia and spoken extremely highly of it. So I looked there. I looked in Ireland, but I applied to Australia and was accepted. So that's where I went.
Now, as you write in your article, Australia is a fascinating place in that, in many ways, it resembles the Western world. Obviously, English speakers, yep. You know, it was part of the Commonwealth, etc. Yet there are certain exotic elements that make it very different from, you know, outside Chicago where you grew up. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah. So this one thing that I wrote about in the article was that, so we were located in a place called Pymble, which is a suburb of Sydney. There were 11 of us from all over the world, from 8 different countries, living in a Australian Jesuit community where there was a retreat house, a place for novices, and a place for older guys who were retired. You know, it was like maybe not quite as nice as Westchester, at least the parts of it that I know a little bit about, or Evanston, Illinois. You know, it was just, you know, a little removed from the city and comfortable, woodsy in a way. Malls and parks and fields and things like that. But then, you know, the thing that's most striking was the birds, that you'd have like these huge parrots flying around screaming like, like, no one, including the Australians, as far as I know, like the cockatoos, these huge, very aggressive white cockatoos that fly around. Or my favorite bird was a bird called the kookaburra, which is a little, it's like a little doll. It's plush, and it has these very human, wise-looking eyes. And it sings at dawn and at dusk, and it sounds exactly like a laughing monkey. And it really does. In fact, if any time you go to a movie and you hear like monkeys laughing in the jungle, it's probably a kookaburra sound that they've used, because it's exactly like you hear in the movies. But these birds are just, you know, these are the natural birds of Australia. So immediately it just felt like, oh, okay, this is very different. This is not what I think. This looks like something that I might know, but it's not what I know.
And you also have, you know, creatures out there that are quite threatening, as you talk about the box jellyfish.
Yeah.
And also these killer seashells.
Yeah, there are lots of, well, I mean, there's a great book by,
Bill Bryson.
Bill Bryson, yes. Yeah, thanks, about Australia, called Down Under, which, I mean, a lot of what he does in the book is at various times he tells you, here's something else that can kill you in Australia, which I showed this article to some Australians, and they said, oh, you know, every American who writes about Australia has to talk about how many ways you'll get killed. But the irony, Richard Leonard, actually from the Australian province, once said this to me. The irony is that you are more likely to be killed in a park in Yellowstone Park than you are any place in Australia because of the bears and the wolves and mountain lions and things like that. But Australia has this kind of reputation for being, you know, very dangerous. You know, another thing, if I may, another thing that wasn't in the article that's really similar, well, it's different about Australia is the government. It's a parliamentary form of government, so it follows the same system as Great Britain, which I had never had any experience with. And what that means is, so there are two houses, just like we have. There's a prime minister who is not elected by the people directly, like we elect the president, but rather he's the leader of his party, and the party that wins the election, their leader becomes the prime minister. And they have this fascinating tradition, which I loved and I still love, called question time, where for an hour, it doesn't happen every week, but maybe it happens, I don't know, 12 weeks of the year. For 1 hour, it's broadcast on sort of their PBS sort of TV. You can, the opposition gets to ask questions of the government. You know, it can get kind of nasty where it's, would the prime minister please speak to page 5 of the Melbourne Age, where he made this incredibly embarrassing comment or was seen with, you know, this woman, or, you know, it can get really negative, but it's actually incredibly interesting. You know, it really asks, ideally it asks the government to explain its policies. It holds them responsible, which we do that in different ways in the United States, but I loved the rhetoric of it. Australian politicians have great linguistic flair that you don't find so much in American politicians. They don't have to, in a sense, in the United States. It can be wonderfully exciting and funny, and I think it's provocative, that way of thinking about government, the way that they're sort of asked, the prime minister and his people are asked to be responsible for their policies in a different kind of a way.
What's interesting, too, is how young Australia is. I mean, as you point out in your article, when the first ships of, you know, the famous convicts arrived in Australia, the United States was already a country.
Yeah.
And it didn't become its own, the colonies in Australia didn't become federated until 1901. So this is, you know, as countries go, we think we're young, but they're very young.
They're a baby. They're just a little cute little baby. Yeah, now all my Australian friends will be like, yeah, we'll get you.
Now, I mean, I guess there's some similarities with the United States in that you have these urban centers, but also these vast expanses of wilderness, although that's nothing like, we don't have anything quite like what's there, which is the outback. But I don't think anybody realizes how big that land is.
I should say this. So for all Americans listening, I was only in Australia 7 months, so I am not an expert. And you should probably talk to an Australian to hear about all the truth of it. So there's probably lots of mistakes in this, but in my limited but partial understanding, Australia is both more urbanized in a sense than I think our country is, and it's much more desolate. It's much more rural. So what do I mean? Like, it's a continent as big as our own. It's a little different shape, but it's pretty much as big as our own, and most of it is empty. The big center. It's desert. It's outback. It's bush. So it's not like sandy desert. It's like we would imagine the Sahara or maybe, you know, Nevada. It's like a red desert, where sometimes in some places it's this ugly kind of scrubby trees. that are really gnarled, and to my mind, it was sort of unpretty, not at all sort of romantic. And then other places are incredibly spectacular romantic, like Uluru, which is in the center of the country, which is a huge rock that just sort of bursts up out of nowhere and is a holy place for some Aboriginal peoples. So it's incredibly incredibly empty and rural in that way, but most of it is unlivable. So Australians mostly live around the edge of the continent in big cities. I think there are 21 or 22 million people in Australia, in the whole of Australia, and maybe 13 or 14 million of them live in the big capital cities that are mostly along the ocean side. So that's just in the capital cities. That's not the other cities that are all along the way. So the interior it's just massive, massive.
Well, you quote here the poet Dorothea McKellar, I'm sure I mispronounced that, who describes Australia as a land of beauty and terror. And, you know, that's quite something. You think we're at a point now where man or human should be able to, you know, conquer any wilderness, but there are still pieces of land, as you say, the great, you know, great part of this country, which is just unlivable.
It's interesting. In February, outside of Melbourne, there were these horrible, in a lot of Victoria, there were these horrible fires, and they were all in the rural places where people lived because they loved the beauty of the forest. The eucalyptus trees, and there are a million varieties in Australia, they're just beautiful trees. And so they live there because it's quiet and the nature and it's beautiful. And then this fire comes, and it was explosive in a way that I don't know that I know of an American fire has been like a forest fire. It swept through communities and destroyed a lot of land. And that's exactly what people there were then saying, is this is exactly what McKellar has said. This, at the same time, there's all of this beauty, and then it can be, you know, you're never in the outback. I was 3 weeks in the outback, and what I found is you're never in charge of it. It's always bigger than you, and that's, I don't know. I don't know of a lot of places in the United States, probably the Grand Canyon, and I'm sure there are some others where you feel that, but it makes you feel very small and vulnerable. But it's also kind of like, so this is the human condition. Thank you for showing that to me, in a sense. You know, like, this is what it's really like. We're not the masters of our destiny in the way that sometimes we can kind of create.
Well, that leads to my next question. I mean, what is it about Australia and the landscape and the people that makes it uniquely suited to the kind of spiritual experience that you were seeking on your internship?
Oh, well, so like I said, there were 11 of us, and I bet if you asked the 11 of us, we'd have at least 11 different answers as to how that worked. For me, and some of this is the landscape, and some of this was the things I was asked to do, the pattern seemed to be that, you know, bring your expectations, you know, great, you have some expectations, now we will crush your expectations. We will show you that your expectations have to be let go of. So then, you know, create some new expectations, and then we'll show you those expectations have. There was like a constant invitation to letting go. And some of that, like the 3 weeks I was in the outback working at this parish and helping with the retreat with this great community, the people of Cobar in New South Wales, just a great, great group of people. But it was, the environment was very challenging in that way of, I don't know, it invites you to sort of let go and not be in control so much. And when I was in Melbourne for 5 weeks working for Jesuit Social Services, which is a great, it's Jesuit funded. It's run by a laywoman named Julie Edwards, really inspirational person, and a lot of great, amazing people on the staff who do lots of different social service projects for mostly young adults on the margins, but not just young adults. They have a bakery, they have a great bakery. They take some young adults and send them on sort of these wilderness experiences for, I think it's a week, maybe 2 weeks, with some really inspirational and smart, talented staff. So, and there too, so that was an urban environment, completely different situation, but I found the same thing that, you know, working in a social service agency, you're constantly having to let go of the kind of expectations you have as to what I'll be doing today, what I'll be doing this week, what will be required of me, and which I found really challenging. I when I came back, I was saying to the other guys, God, I was so frustrated. And yet I knew that that was how I should feel, you know, that was, that kind of experience will help me in the long term, even though it was not entirely pleasurable. Though the people were great. A great lesson for me is you can have really somewhat unpleasant experiences, and yet my memories are entirely positive. even those sort of hard time, the hard times, I don't know, I sort of think of in a very positive light.
Yeah, you write in your article that you really fell in love with the place and you didn't want to leave.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone wants to send me back to Australia. Yeah, I did. I really felt like after the long retreat especially.
Which this is the 30-day spiritual exercises.
Yeah, which your 30 days, we were in the mother house of the Australian province in this place called Seven Hill, which is in South Australia. It's wine country, and actually this place we were at is the only Jesuit vineyard in the world, the Seven Hill Vineyard, or in the United States, I think it's St. Ignatius is the brand of the wine. Great wine, beautiful. It was like Tuscany, the terrain. And I did fall in love, I think, with the land there. And then after that, with the people as well, it all kind of opened up.
So maybe we can just end your article's Gone Walkabout. And for those of us who only know about Australia from Baz Luhrmann movies, we know, I mean, that's a phrase.
And Russell Crowe incidents.
Russell Crowe, right. Arrest record.
It's just like that. If you're thinking of a Baz Luhrmann movie, it's just like that. It moves just that fast all the time.
There's always singing and dancing. You can look at pictures and learn more about Jim McDermott's trip. You blogged about it, correct?
I do. Yeah. In fact, I started a blog, which was it eponymous if it's your name?
Yes, it is, I believe. JimMcDermott.blogspot.com. And you've got some beautiful shots up there. So,
thanks.
People should check that out. And we should also say that fellow Jim McDermott is moving on from the staff of America just the end of this month. So we're going to miss him. He's the voice of the podcast here. So, but we hope, we wish him luck.
No, Tim, you are the voice of the you are the voice of the podcast. You are the mind behind the podcast.
Well, we want to thank him for all his contributions and wish him well.
Oh, thanks. It's been a pleasure working here, and I will. I am always grateful to our readers for their attention and support.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. Next week, we'll be talking with Julie Zimmerman, who has an article for us on infidelity and advice for Catholics facing that difficult issue. We'll also have a slideshow in honor of Daniel Berrigan, who just turned 90. I want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provides the music for this show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.